The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I would like to tell a story that comes from the ancient Buddhist tradition. And the reason to tell the story is certainly to participate in one of the most important features of all religions is to tell stories. There are people who say that what's most important for... You can hear it out there? Isn't that working? Let's see, is it on? Is it loud enough, everyone, in here? And for out there, is that speaker's not on?
It's on, it's just not.
Well, maybe try turning the knob there and see if maybe that's been turned down up there. And if I keep talking, then
that
make it worse. Yeah, there is a way of turning up the volume for that, but I don't know how to do it by itself. Usually it's stronger out there than in here. There are more spaces in here if you want. Okay. So religions, some people have said that what's more important for the popularity of religions is not their doctrinal beliefs, but the stories they tell. That stories touch people's hearts, they guide people in how to behave and what's important for them and their imagination. And that's certainly true with Buddhism as well. And stories are so important that for human beings in general, that I think it's maybe a mistake to have given us the species name of sapien, Homo sapiens. You know, there are other creatures who are quite, have a lot of understanding, are sapient, kind of, you know, all kinds of creatures. And to kind of use that as the primary characteristics of humans kind of doesn't really highlight what's unique about us. I think we should be called Homo storikos. That's what's unique about human beings. All this understanding and knowledge we have and imagination, creativity gets poured into creating stories. And we create stories about the future, the past, the mythic times. And the thing about stories, and this is a kind of dramatic teachings that Zen Buddhism tends to give, there are stories that kill and stories that give life. There are stories that undermine us, and there are stories that enliven us. And rather than just kind of dismissing stories outright, the part of the idea is to understand how to engage in the storytelling aspect of our mind so that it benefits us rather than undermines us. It's said that one of the primary causes of depression is rumination, that people tell stories all the time in our minds, and some of those stories that we tell ourselves repeatedly actually are debilitating. And we don't think that we're storytellers. And maybe if you speak out loud, you would see that your stories are not that clever. But when they're somehow being said quietly in our own mind, they seem really important and valuable. And it doesn't matter they're not clever, they're real. Sometimes they're more real than the reality we live in because of the way we relate to them. So religions tell stories, and Buddhism does that. And there's a story it tells that's meant to be more liberating than not. And it uses some of the whole story uses some of the more sophisticated or best techniques of Indian storytelling. So if you really went into the original text, you'll see that it's, quite a wonderful crafted, story. It comes from the middle-length discourses, so it has a certain kind of scriptural status. And I studied it recently because there's one teaching in there that's been very important for me, very inspiring for me. And sometimes I even quote it or paraphrase it. And that teaching is, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. Wow, that's like a big statement. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. Some of you might immediately want to protest that you have ideas. No, but we have to cling. We can't live without clinging. And some of you will argue and debate. That's okay. But that's not what we do today. So this teaching exists as part of the story. It's a feature, a really important feature of the story. But this is how the story goes. I think of the story in my mind, and the story, I embellish the story because my mind is a storyteller too. And how I embellish it, I think of it as almost being operatic. And maybe even was performed in the ancient world. And one of the ways that I think some of these ancient stories in suttas, these scriptures, were performed was that different storytellers or monks would be the different characters in the story, and they'd go back and forth with just who was speaking it. Maybe one person was the narrator. So the story involves the Buddha sitting quietly, meditating perhaps, and he's visited by one of the most grand, wonderful, most powerful, ruling gods of the heavens. That's quite an honor to have this great God come down from the heavens to see the Buddha. But he comes to ask the Buddha a question, which also then elevates the status of the Buddha. Wow, this great God, Shakra, in Sanskrit. People in India know him more as Indra. So Shakra comes to the Buddha. And part of the context for him coming is he's heard the Buddha's teachings before, and he was really deeply impacted by it. He had something awakened in him. And so he came, because of that, he came to ask a really important question. He asked, how does a person become liberated? Okay, now we're talking about important teachings. So now we should all be on the edge of our seats. Or you're sitting there in a wonderful forest clearing on a full moon, and it's all peaceful and quiet, and the storyteller is telling the story. How? Shakra saying, how do you get liberated? Okay. So I'll paraphrase. The Buddha answers, but the key thing he says, first, one hears the teaching. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And hearing that teaching, a person becomes disinterested in clinging, begins to let go of clinging, and their mind gets less and less agitated until it becomes peaceful. And there's a deep, deep release, a liberation of letting go of all clinging. That's how it is. So it's a relatively simple teaching. and Shakra says, thank you. And he says, I have a lot of things to take care of up in heaven. And so he goes back. Well, listening to this is a monk who's sitting in meditation nearby named Mahamudgalyana. It's one of the two kind of senior disciples of the Buddha. And he has psychic powers. And he wonders, did Shakya really understand what the Buddha said? Is he going to remember what the Buddha said? And so he uses psychic powers that is as quickly as it takes for a strong person to flex their elbow. He goes up there to heaven. And in Shakya's heaven, he's a big ruling god of a whole corner of the heavens himself. So there's lots of levels of heavens in Buddhism. So there's no shortage. If there could be heavens, Buddhists will do good stories. And so they create stories of layers and layers of heavens. So Shakra, he's the ruler of one of the great levels. And it's a vast realm. And so there's different ways a story is told, but Shakra seems to, in one story, Shakra is, is in a wonderful, he has this wonderful, huge, majestic, unbelievably large palace. And he has gardens and pleasure gardens. And he has this great pond, a lake or pool, where he's cavorting or resting with all these celestial ladies. And all this music being played. So he's having a good time. And Mahamogliana comes along. And so this monk comes, and Tsaka recognizes him and gets out of the pool and goes up to him and says, "Oh, how wonderful that you're here." And Mahamogliana, "Yes, I'm here to ask you, do you remember what the Buddha said to you when you asked if you were, you know, what's the way to become liberated?" And Tsaka says, "Oh, I have too many important things to take care of, being the ruler of this heaven, and to kind of be involved and kind of remember that right now. But let me tell you about how I had recently was in war with another part of the heavens, the Asuras, the Titans, and how I conquered the Titans, and because of that, I came back and built this huge, extra big palace to celebrate that victory in battle. And the palace has 700 towers. Each tower with 700 turrets, and each turret with 700 rooms, and each 700 rooms has 700 celestial maidens, with each maiden has 100 celestial female attendants. I mean, if you do the math, it's like millions of these celestial ladies and whatever, and who are there in his palace, in this big palace. So here's this guy who heard this wonderful teaching from the Buddha. The monk asks him, "Do you remember?" It's a relatively short teaching. And he goes on and on to say, "Let me tell you about all the details of my palace and how wonderful it is." And he says, "Let me give you a tour." And so Mahamogliana says, "Okay." And so he starts giving him a tour. And again, you know, he could have just stopped. And what does he need to give a tour for? So after a while, Mogliana says, "You know, this guy, he has no sense of spiritual importance, no sense of spiritual urgency. So what if I do a psychic feat to awaken a sense of urgency?" So remember, they're walking through this amazingly massive, celestially solid palace. So Tsaka takes his big toe and he taps it onto the floor of the palace. And the whole palace starts to shake. Earthquake. Palace quake. And that gets Tsaka's attention because, wow, if my solid palace is so fragile, can shake, can be inconstant, is so impermanent by just this monk tapping it with his foot, I mean, he's really powerful. And this is really, this world maybe is more fragile than I realized. And maybe I better not just take it for granted that this will be here forever and that I'll be here forever and that I'm so powerful myself. Now I've kind of been humbled. And so then the monk realizes, okay, good. The great God has now awakened a sense of urgency and spiritual importance. Let me ask him now. Do you remember what the Buddha said to you when you asked him how to become liberated? Oh, yeah. He said, "Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to." And a person who realizes this will become disinterested in clinging. Their clinging will relax and quiet. Their mind will be less agitated because clinging is agitating for the mind. And when the mind is no longer agitated, something will let go very deeply, which is the synonym of liberation. And the story goes on a little bit more, but that's the key part of the story. And my imagination, my operatic imagination of this full moon night, people are listening, that people are in awe. Maybe back then people believed in Sakka and his heavens, and maybe they believed this was a real story, that was this really happened. And so they're sitting there absorbed, because storytelling was one of the primary entertainments of the time. Remember, there was no Netflix and no movies and no TVs and no novels to be read and comic books to be read. And, you know, there was stories is what there was, stories and songs and poems and oral culture. And so the storytellers were really good and painted a picture that pulled people in. And for them to hear that the palace, even Shaka, was impermanent and shaking, that maybe awakened their sense of now they're interested in the spirituality or what the teachings were. Tell us. And then they hear there's nothing is worth clinging to. And maybe it was told in grand storytelling techniques with a pause and an emphasis or something. And maybe it touched their hearts. Maybe it touched something deeper than where their neurotic rumination lived. That, you know, an ordinary kind of storytelling mind that we get caught in with our resentments and our desires and our greeds and our fears, quieted as they heard the story. And so they were ready to receive something. Nothing is worth clinging to. Boom. And something maybe happened to those people listening. So that is an example of storytelling that's meant to be liberating, enlivening, freeing. Stories that are entrapments, stories that we get stuck in, are many forms. But one of the primary forms of how we get stuck in stories is through what Buddhism calls the five hindrances. The five hindrances are, or they're actually obscurations. They're stories we tell ourselves that are rooted in sensual desire, the first hindrance, ill will, the second, resistance and lethargy, resistance and shutting down, the third. The fourth is restlessness and regrets, remorse. And the fifth is uncertainty, uncertainty about how to find our way to freedom. And so these five, part of the reason they're so powerful and why they're called hindrances is that what hinders them, or what the literal Pali word for this word hindrance literally means to cover over, and it covers over our capacity for wisdom. It covers over our capacity for clarity. It covers over our capacity to understand how we're caught. We're so distracted. We're distracted by distractions. We're so distracted by distractions we don't know we're distracted. Isn't that nice? It's nice for distractions. And so the hindrances, the reason they're so powerful and why it's so hard for people to get out of these mind states is the stories that we tell around them. Desires, especially sensual desires, sometimes they're very pleasant, and the pleasure of the story keeps us addicted to him. Sometimes the promise of the story sometimes is so compelling. Sometimes stories of pleasure, sensual pleasure especially, usually put us personally into a good place. And maybe it's part of a delusion of grandeur. Maybe we have a lot of lack in our lives, a lot of challenges and problems, and maybe a lot of pain and distress in our lives. And so fantasies of pleasure and wonderful fantasies of all kinds of pleasant things somehow fulfill and compensate for how we feel maybe a lack of something. And that's what keeps us caught in these wonderful stories. They're a balm. They're kind of like, feel like they're reassurance for ourselves. I'm okay after all. Look, I have 100 celestial maidens attending to my every desire. That's kind of, you know, for some people it's okay. And or ill will. Stories of anger, stories of hostility, stories of resentment are powerful. And part of the reason that people are so attracted to them is some people feel a sense of personal power and a sense of rightness and righteousness. And that's what keeps us locked in. We tell the story over and over again because then we feel like we're important. We feel like we're taking care of ourselves. We feel something important. We get something from the story. And so we'll tell the story over and over and over again. Sometimes we get a sense of identity. This is how we create a sense of self around sometimes resentment. Like they're wrong and I'm right. And so we tell the story over and over again. Resistance stories of its story then can be very, very simple stories and shutting off, giving up. The story might be only, maybe it's three words. Story. It's too much. I can't do it. That goes over and over again. I'm overwhelmed, overwhelmed. This is overwhelming. And so we tell ourselves these stories, and they're draining, they're discouraging, they're distressing. They reinforce a certain kind of way of understanding ourselves. I am this way. And we tell it over and over and over again. And the repetition of it slowly begins to drain us, creates a mood, creates an atmosphere inside that can be quite difficult to live with. The sad thing about the way that these unfortunate stories work on us is that they kind of disconnect us from a deep connection to ourselves. It keeps us in the story-making world and creating more distress, more bad feelings. And then the only way the mind knows how to compensate for that is to tell more stories. It tells more stories. Like one story, like, I can't, I'm not good enough, kind of shutting down like this, is that we have the proof of it. I'm just feeling lousy. I've shut down. I've gotten so giving. I'm giving up, and that just proof that I'm really bad, and therefore I feel worse, and therefore you'll say it more. It's kind of like what happened when I was maybe in my mid-20s. I was working at a bakery, and I loved baguettes. It was my comfort food. What I didn't know, I had developed an allergy to wheat. And I didn't make the connection, so I would feel bad from eating wheat. So my comfort food was to eat baguettes, and I'd feel worse. But I didn't know that, so I ate more. And there were times that my mind went into a stupor because I was so affected by this allergy I had, until finally I realized the connection. So some people, their mind that works that way with their stories. We don't even know it, and we tell more stories. We don't affect. Then there's stories of that cause us to be restless. Stories of regret and remorse, we say over and over again. And then there's stories of uncertainty, stories of doubt we tell ourselves. And the Buddha, the primary, most dangerous story of indecisiveness, uncertainty, doubt, is we don't know what is healthy for us and what is unhealthy. Maybe in the way I'm talking about today, we can't recognize when the stories we tell ourselves are helpful for us and useful and maybe liberating, and when we tell stories to ourselves which are debilitating. To be able to see that, if you don't see that, then we can tell ourselves stories of doubt, on and on. So stories. What stories do you tell? Are you a storyteller? If you're a Homo sapien, you are a storyteller. I guarantee it. You might think you're very logical. You might think you're very reasoned, everything. There are very logical stories. Very reasonable stories that have been put together with a lot of building blocks. They're stories. What effect do these stories have on you? what is the state of mind? What is the state of heart? What's your inner mood and state when you're telling yourself these stories? Is it a state of mind? Is it a state of heart that is healthy? Is the effect, the consequence, these stories you tell, the ruminations you have, are they healthy? If they aren't, don't tell a despairing story about that. Don't add unfortunate stories on top of unfortunate stories. At some point, realize what you're doing and see if you can tell a better story. Not one that's kind of just fantasy, but something that is freeing, creates clarity, openness, creates a sense of aliveness, not because you're going to story of winning the California lottery, but rather a story that, because it inspires the best in your heart to come forth. It's okay to tell some stories. Maybe the stories that help you to tell you, you know, I think I've heard once upon a time that being mindful is a good idea. That's a good story. Let me see. Let me live that story. Let me be mindful of all the storytelling I'm making. And maybe that is better. Maybe you've heard once upon a time the story, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. Well, I'm not sure it is a good story, but I don't have any better at the moment. So let me try that out. Maybe there's a few extra things I'm clinging to today that I don't have to cling to. What would happen if I let go of that? Maybe I'm just telling the story one more time of this partner I had, sweetheart I had 50 years ago. I can say that now. 50 years ago. And maybe I don't have to cling to that story anymore. Maybe it's safe to let go of it. In my case, she probably doesn't even remember me. So why am I caught in this? Stories. So that's the talk for today. And the story behind this story behind this talk, it's always a story. It's not so interesting, but I'm going off this afternoon to teach a week-long retreat at our retreat center in Santa Cruz. And part of the retreat will be about the five hindrances and how they are story-making, how story-making is integral to how strongly they hold us. So I'm kind of warming up here. So we have about 15 minutes about this, or something nice about your conversations. We have a couple of minutes before we'll stop for the potluck.
Thank you, Gil. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about my interpretation of, you know, nothing is worth clinging to is very, very different from maybe everything is worth cherishing or loving, or because I think sometimes hearing nothing is worth clinging to seems like a very depressing
story.
But I hear it now to say something different, that, you know, moment by moment, there's always something to cherish, to love, I think it would be helpful to hear.
I think that it's more nuanced in Buddhism, this kind of thing. Generally, there's not this world-affirming teachings in Buddhism that everything should be cherished or something. There's also not a world-negating teaching nothing's worth clinging to is not meant to negate anything. It's not meant to be a judgment about the world. It's really, if it's a judgment, it's a judgment about the pain we're causing ourselves by clinging. So the world is what it is. And we make the whole world worse if we cling. Mostly what we read about in the newspaper is so awful. The news has to do with someone clinging. It would be a phenomenally different good world if there wasn't any clinging. And but part of what this what the orientation in Buddhism, the Buddhist teachings, is not to replace freedom from clinging, with some positive, clear positive statement, like everything should be cherished now. And part of the reason for that, then it's too easy to get attached to that. And part of it is because it's kind of limiting. What's better is to just let the heart be free from all these views, all these ideas, all these, and then see, give room for the heart to give birth to whatever is needed in a particular time. Sometimes cherishing is not what's needed. Sometimes compassion is what's needed. Sometimes something else is needed. And so this freedom from clinging, it's kind of like what the early Buddhism believes is the heart is really good, deep inside. And if we remove the obstacles to that goodness, then that goodness will come forth in all kinds of different ways as needed. Does that make some sense to you?
No, that makes sense. And I think maybe cherishing was the wrong word, but what brought to my mind was sort of thinking about the Brahma Viharas, yeah, and thinking about that there can be joy even in the midst of suffering. There, yes, can be, you know, that there isn't sort of this sort of retreat.
Yeah.
The letting go or the, you know, not clinging doesn't require sort of this retreat. It can involve, can really have this deep engagement with whatever is going on. So maybe it's sort of engagement or really being there,
yeah,
and being with whatever's going on. And maybe cherishing that you're alive, whether you're suffering or you're joyful or you're watching the world burn or whatever it is. So it just, yeah, just kind of wanted to, yeah, respond to feeling, yeah, like that, not being detached.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe we come to the same results that what you're trying to say. But I think in this early Buddhism, we're not making a statement about the world out there, but rather a statement about how we can be in this world. So it's a 180-degree turn, and maybe to make a statement similar to what you said, at all times, it's good to love. At all times, it's good to care. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, almost all cultures that I... Is this working?
No? Yeah.
I'll just talk loudly.
No, no, it's partly...
Can you hold that YouTube channel? Oh. So if you can hold it like a rock star...
So all cultures that I know of have stories that help guide the members of those societies through stages of their lives. And often they're like fairy tales or mythological stories that are concerned with guiding through this life. I'm wondering if Buddhism has stories like that.
It is full of stories. All religions are primarily storytelling traditions, and Buddhism is full of stories. And it goes on and on. I mean, one that's quite famous for people is the Jataka tales, which are all these like Aesop fable kind of fables. There's a story of the Buddha's life, which is really engaging and informing, and some of the values of what Buddhism is about are embedded in that story of the Buddha's own life. And that's told over and over again. there are particular incidents in the Buddha's life which are repeated a lot over and over again. And then there are stories of his disciples that are told. There are mythic stories, fables that are created. Someone, Buddha or someone, created a fable about the kind of an origin story. Every self-respecting religion has an origin story for the, and so Buddhism has one too. So there's lots and lots of stories, no shortage of stories. And what's happened in the kind of Western convert Buddhist circles that I go in, like in the Insight movement that I'm part of, for the most part, I think many of the teachers don't do a lot of stories. It's much more rational discourse and technique focused and practical orientation towards it. And sometimes only very few of the stories are told. And sometimes the Pharaoh's those few, like the top five, are told over and over again. But a brilliant storyteller in our tradition is Jack Kornfield. He uses stories all the time. And he even co-authored an anthology of stories that is called, it changed its title. So there are stories.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, you can spend lifetimes with the stories.
So I'm talking about stories that, like, take people through the stages of life.
I couldn't hear.
Oh, it's like I'm talking about stories that take people through the stages of life, like becoming a man, becoming a woman, marriage, you know, having a child. Those are all encapsulated a lot in mythologies and other cultural tales. I'm wondering if Buddhist society has stories like that.
Not the stages of life that way. I don't think so. I mean, when I think about other religions I know, they don't have really clear... Hinduism has some kind of ideas of clear stages, but a clear set of stories that goes through that. I mean, the Buddha, there is a Buddha's... We have a story of how the Buddha went through his life, and I don't know if that works as a model for too many people who are householders with kids. Okay. So thank you very much, and you can continue your stories at the potluck if you want.